Welcome to this episode of the Customer Centric Retailing Podcast. This is Anil Patel, founder and CEO of Hotwax Commerce. In this podcast, we discuss e-commerce, omnichannel technology, pre-order management, brick and mortar operations, retail culture, innovation, and how all these elements come together to create customer centric retailing. Join us to hear the brightest minds in the retail industry share their experiences and thoughts on the most relevant topics today. Today, we have a special guest, Mark Pilkington. He has a long, very rich experience in retailing. So let's welcome Mark. Mark, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Anil.
Awesome. Mark, you know, we've seen that you have a really long, lot of experience in retailing, and you've done multiple things, worked with the leading brands. Can you tell us more about, in depth about your, you know, your experiences, and particularly what inspired you to write this book, Retail Recovery?
Well, I've worked in a number of different stages of the consumer supply chain. So I started my career in manufacturers' brands. So we were selling to retailers. We had our own factories. So that was sort of upstream in the chain. Then later on, I started an e-commerce company. And so I got some experience of that channel. And then later after that, I went into retailing proper, and I spent about 10 years running a stores group with about 850 stores. And I think that the combination of those elements, manufacturing, brands, retailing, and e-commerce, gave me a perspective on the current changes in the retail and consumer sector that have been going on for the last 5 or 10 years, which I felt was unusual, because most of the commentators are either academic theoreticians or they are pure retailers who've really grown up in retailing. And I felt that the fact that I'd seen all stages of the supply chain gave me a unique perspective. And it seemed to me kind of obvious about what was happening in the supply chain with the internet revolution. And I wanted to write about that. So that's really what got me into writing. I felt I could see things that other people didn't seem to be able to see, and understood the broader context of what was going on. And then it led me on. I wrote my first book, Retail Therapy, about that. And then as I deepened my knowledge of the sector, I came to understand the role that really all the players are brands, essentially, and the channels are just channels. So you don't really have retailers and brands and even malls these days. Everyone really is a brand, a multi-channel brand of one sort or another. So I think I look at everything as brands, as opposed to like retailers and other types of players. And that's what I did in the second book, Retail Recovery, which really focuses on how you create a modern, what I call a new generation brand.
Yeah, this is interesting, you know. That's really impressive, because your experience from supply chain and then into e-commerce and then into retailing gives you the holistic experience of what we what today we see as a comprehensive and very, you know, detailed omni-channel retailing experience, because our customers are all over today. Like, it's not only physical. You just don't just drive to the store and walk in, but you can also reach out to the store online. So there's a lot of changes happen, and your experience is so much relevant today because of all these different dimensions of retailing you have experienced yourself. So I'm sure you must be seeing all these trends that are coming in, where people are getting more digital savvy, but then the retailers are not moving fast enough. And then the pandemic hit and all those physical retail was crippled. So in general, how do you see this broader picture of post-pandemic, how the retailing is going to evolve and what the new kind of retailing is going to be? Tell me about what your vision of modern-day retailing looks like.
Well, I think obviously we had the build-up pre-pandemic of, you know, the effect of the internet revolution, which of course is not just e-commerce, it's also the communications revolution of, you know, people like things like customer reviews and social media and things like that. And we also had generational changes in the consumer base. That was all building up from about 2014-15 onwards, and had already caused considerable damage in certain markets to retail by the time we got to COVID. But I think that during that period, there was a debate as to how serious the revolution was, and a lot of retailers were pushing back, saying everyone's exaggerating with this talk of a retail apocalypse. And then COVID happened, and the stores were physically shut down, and I think that ended the debate, because obviously the first thing is there was a massive increase in the internet penetration. Like in the UK, it went from 19% up to like 33%. So suddenly it becomes a really serious channel, a lifeline actually to retailers. And many small retailers only actually went online because of the pandemic. So I think in the aftermath of the pandemic, no one doesn't take the internet channel seriously. No one believes that there wasn't a revolution. And I think in that respect, it's created a kind of reset in retailers' minds, large and small. The large players are now spending serious amounts on developing large online channels. And many of them now are up to having 25, 30, 35% of their business through e-commerce. So it's become a serious channel for them. And you know, it's starting to be more viable from a profitability point of view. So, you know, I think that perspective, that reset, has actually created the circumstances for a retail recovery, which is why the title of the second book is Retail Recovery.
Awesome. So, like, you know, like you said, the share of digital transactions in the whole retail business has grown from whatever it was in single digit to like 25%, 30% of the revenue. Do you think that, you know, a lot of retailers would now maybe go a little too much on the digital side because they see that there is a lesser, you know, investment, or maybe they see that everything is going digital, so we should just focus on e-commerce and the brick and mortar retail doesn't need to change much? Or do you think the stores have to evolve and there will be a mix of digital and physical? And in that sense, how is the digital going to evolve, and particularly how it is going to complement our retail locations, the physical retail? Because now that the new mix with the digital taking such a big share of our retail, the physical or the brick and mortar retailing cannot simply ignore. They need to also upgrade themselves, change themselves, evolve, and see what is the role of stores going forward. So how do you see that role of the stores evolving? What are the different roles the stores will take, and how are retailers going to, you know, adopt all these new retailing strategies, particularly in the store operations?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There is no question that some retailers went too fast towards reducing their investment in their stores and put all their money into e-commerce, and that didn't work out too well. And there's some examples. I think in the UK we had Mothercare, which really invested very strongly in its online and really just thought, we're just going to shut down our stores network. And that didn't work out very well for them, because the closure of the stores had an effect on the brand. And many online retailers find that, you know, having a store in the market actually helps their online business. So I do believe they're very complementary, and that retailers can't give up on the stores arm of their business. Rather, they need to invest in both if they can, to change the role that each channel plays. Because I think that a lot of people just talk about multi-channel as if all channels were equal, if you like, and I don't see it that way. I think that different channels have very real different strengths and weaknesses, and both channels can be improved, in fact, but retailers and brands should start to look at those channels as how they can use them in a complementary way.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I agree with you, because like these physical store, our, you know, retailing, the physical brick and mortar retailing is a it's a really good, I would say, your media. It is a good place to acquire new customers, engage your existing customers, so the experiences can be delivered using those stores, which generally is not easily achievable with the e-commerce. At the same time, e-commerce allows us to deliver a lot of convenience because my customers can browse the whole entire catalog. They can also get recommendations. They can complete their purchase online and get the item delivered to their home. So there's like, you know, both channels or all these different, you know, channels have their own strengths and weaknesses, but then working together, they can complement each other and help us deliver a very good customer experience. In fact, you also talk a lot about running those stores like e-commerce. So when we think about running our brick and mortar locations as e-commerce, so what do you think? What do you envision? Like, how would a retailer go about doing that?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at the strengths and weaknesses of the channels, as you say, online is a great transactional medium, and you know, in lots of ways, it's got search engines which stores don't have. Pretty reliable in terms of the consistency of the experience. Generally, you know, these days most websites and apps operate in a stable way, whereas the store experience is very variable depending on how many staff there are and how they're feeling. And of course, online is typically much better at being in stock than stores because you've got one centralized warehouse holding the stock. Whereas with stores, the stock is dispersed over a large number of branches, and it's quite possible that one branch will have a lot of stock of something and another branch will have none. And things like pricing and product information is very clearly laid out online in a very consistent way, whereas in store it's not. And then in terms of customer service, at its best, of course, a store can be better, but very often you can't find someone to help you, and even just checking out can be, you know, you may have to queue or go and find somebody. Whereas online, you know, you've got one click checkout. If they've got your credit card details, it really couldn't be easier. And, you know, as you say, there's then the additional element of having it delivered to your home. Whereas, you know, we sort of tend to forget that in the traditional supply chain, the consumer was part of the supply chain because they actually covered the final mile to the home. And that's now been cut out, which is one of the sort of, you know, one of the perhaps less well-known benefits of the online. So, and I think that, you know, that convenience will only get greater over time. I think we're going to have houses with delivery ports built into them, even refrigerated ports in the future, where, and with code protected ports, so that, you know, the consumer won't even have to be in order to get the delivery. And it may go, some, you know, food deliveries could even go straight to the back of your larder or your fridge, you know. So you know, I have sort of a vision of how that may evolve. So it's just going to get more and more convenient. On the other hand, you know, it's a cold medium at this stage, although it may improve due to virtual reality. It doesn't feel like you're really experiencing the brand in the same way as if you go into a store. So there's no question that if a store is done right, which in my view most 95% of stores aren't, so it's difficult for people to imagine how it could be, but because I think most stores are just piles of stock, piles and piles of stock sitting around with a little fringe of branding, a little fringe of customer service. So they're not really very good at actually doing all the things that stores could do. But there are some examples of stores where, you know, they've understood the shift and they've moved away from that model towards using the store as more of a brand experience location. But stores unquestionably could be, with the use of technology and high-level staff, could be wonderful theatrical brand experiences. You know, where you get to sample the brand, you know, try best sellers, and the brand can learn about the consumers in a deeper way through spending more time with them and understanding all of their needs, a broader range of their needs, so that all of that can be put into the brand system so that they can serve that individual customer better. And stores also, we can talk a bit more about branding because there's a lot of work that I do about branding as well, but stores also can be great places to celebrate community, the brand community events, and through the community sort of spending time together in one physical place, and also to learn, you know, it can be an educational experience for them. So I think stores are great for, you know, education, they're great for branding, they're great for high-level customer service and getting to know the customer, and then the online is great for transacting. And to me, that's the correct balance between the two channels.
Awesome. Yeah. So, like, you know, when we are bringing the customer into the store, they are expecting more of a physical interaction because it's part of their experience. They come out of home for a reason because it gives them certain level of pleasure. So the stores cannot simply be a place for transaction because person is coming in with the purpose of having some kind of a pleasure, some kind of a fun, some social activity. So like you said, you know, there has to be the store associates, the engagement level at that by the store associates should be much higher quality because people are expecting. If I just needed a transaction to be done, I could have ordered it online and got the item delivered to my home, right? And like you said, the last mile, I don't have to do it myself as a consumer and shipping company will take care of it. But if I'm coming to the store, then I'm coming there for a reason. And also for the brands, it's a really good opportunity to engage the customer and retain them for a longer period of time. So from there in, like, you know, you also talk a lot about like how classic retail model is evolving and the new next generation multi-channel brand retailing is coming up. Can you elaborate more on that concept? What is on your mind and how the retailing can be, you know, improved or
Well, as I say, I think that with COVID and with the great reset that's happened, every player in the market now has to think of themselves as a multi-channel brand. And I mean, whether that's wholesale brands, whether it's e-commerce, direct-to-consumer, pure digital brands, whether that's retail brands or even malls, which I think are going to become brands as well, or, you know, the big online marketplaces, they all have to think of themselves as brands that are kind of free-floating across multiple channels. Whether that those channels be wholesale, whether those channels be mail order, whether those channels be e-commerce or social commerce, or whether those channels be physical stores or physical malls. So to me, that's part of the great reset, that everyone has to think of themselves as a brand. So if you think of yourself as a brand, you then have to question, what does it take to create a brand in this modern environment? And a big part of my work is helping people understand that what it took before to create a brand or a retailer or any of these is not what it takes now. Because basically, and this is the big picture, we've moved from an oligopoly situation with a few players in each vertical to perfect competition. So if you look at the historical classical brand retail supply chain, it was dominated both at the brand level and the retail level by relatively few players in each geographical market and each product vertical. So think as a consumer in 1991, you know, where could you buy things? Well, you could get in your car and drive maybe for 10 miles. So it was all the stores, you know, within 10 miles of you, okay? And if it was a more specialist item, that was probably only two or three stores, right? That was your choice. That was your universe of where you could buy from. And the stores that controlled those locations, once they'd been built and once, you know, there was an established retail chain out there, it was very hard for new people to break in because it was very expensive to build stores and develop a new store group. And if at the branding level, the supply chain, it was the same. You know, you had relatively few brands in each vertical. They were well established. They had big sales forces with established trade relationships with the retailers. They had big advertising budgets, and it was really hard for new people to break in. And as a result, there were relatively few of them in each sector. So both at the brand level and the retail level, you've got relatively few players. And so what is your competitive advantage? Well, basically incumbency, being there, having been built before was your competitive advantage. And you didn't actually need to do a whole lot more than this in order to succeed. Or if you were a brand, you had to develop some products, segment the market, develop products for the segments, and run mass advertising. And if you're a retailer, you had to accept the products from the brands, have your store open, and have a few staff in the store, and make sure you were in stock. That's all you needed to be a retail brand or a manufacturer's brand. These days, the universe has changed. So firstly, the barriers to entry have dropped enormously. So the cost of getting a Shopify website, having a great product idea, and promoting it over social media like TikTok have come down dramatically. And it doesn't depend on how much money you've got. It depends more about how unique your idea is and how good you are at communicating that idea. So it's nothing to do with the having vast amounts of money. It's to do with your skills and your level of innovation and the way that you treat your customers, the way that you interact with your customers. So the barriers to entry have dropped. And what we've seen in most verticals and geographies is two things. Firstly, there's been a massive wave of startups, which have been highly innovative and have developed whole new ways of branding and dealing with their customers, and much more innovative in terms of products. And the second thing we've seen, which is not often recognised, is we've had a massive influx of international brands into geographical markets. So, you know, as I say, 20, 30 years ago, if you were in Britain, you were dealing with, you know, a bunch of British brands, essentially, maybe some American brands. But now, if you go in, you know, if you go on Google and put any product category in, you're going to get people from all around the world selling to you. You're going to get literally millions of people trying to sell to you. So the number of players has approached what we call perfect competition, because there's almost an infinite number of players competing for that consumer dollar. The other thing that's changed, which is also one of the preconditions for perfect competition, is consumer knowledge. So if you look in 1991, where did consumers get their information about products? Well, a little bit of word of mouth, but people's ability to communicate to each other as peers was very limited. They used to say that people used to tell seven. If they had a good experience or a bad experience, they used to tell an average of seven people. So it wasn't very much. Secondly, mainly where you got your information from was from the brands and the retailers themselves. It's from their advertising or from store staff or whatever. That's where you got information. So it was hardly objective information. It was very biased information. And if the brand had enough money to tell you that it was great, you probably believed that it was great, even if it wasn't. There was no objective measure of brands. And what we've got now is another element of the internet revolution is what I call communications revolution, which is things like social media and peer product reviews. So now, where do most people get their information about products? They get it either from people they know, but people have a much bigger universe of who they can communicate with. If you've had a great brand experience, you can now tell 7,000 people on your social media feed, not seven people. And secondly, you don't get it from the brands anymore, you get it from peer reviews. So the first thing you do if you want to decide what brand to do is you go on Google or you go on Amazon or whatever, or you go on Trustpilot and you read the reviews. And those reviews, they're not always great, we know that, they're not always, and they can be faked or whatever, but they're a whole lot more objective than when it used to be from the manufacturers themselves. And that's what people trust. So consumers' trust in manufacturer messaging has gone down completely, and their trust in their peers has gone up. So that is the communications revolution, and that has changed. That's changed the dynamic, because one of the preconditions for perfect competition is perfect consumer knowledge. And now the consumer more or less has perfect knowledge of all the brands out there. So those two changes, the drop in the barriers and the rise in consumer knowledge, has turned it from oligopoly into perfect competition, where the consumer now is faced with millions of brands competing for their business. It's changed the whole balance of power between producers and consumers, because basically 30 years ago the consumer was like Pavlov's dogs. You know, you researched it, you segmented it, you developed products, you've worked out what the consumer's buttons were, emotional buttons, you pressed the buttons with mass advertising, and the consumers obediently turned up in store and took away the products. Now, the consumer is much more powerful than that, much more active, and of course the web is an interactive medium, and now, encouraged by the new brands that are coming in that are being very innovative in this regard, consumers expect a much more interactive relationship with brands. They expect to be listened to. They expect to be much more involved. If they're going to give that dollar to a brand, they want something more than just a transaction. And that's the key. So we've had a massive competitive shift. And I think most people miss that, because most people focus on the channels and the nuts and bolts of how you're going to build the channels or whatever. And they miss the big picture, which is that in that very tough Arctic world of millions of competitors, what it takes to succeed as a brand has completely changed. You can't just have a transactional focus. You can't just have a product. It's not good enough anymore. 30 years ago, if you had that product in your store on the right day when the advertising was being run, that was enough. And the consumer only expected to come in and transact. They come in, pick it up, and go away. They didn't expect anything more. But if you have that mentality today, you're going to be in the cesspool with millions of people with much lower cost bases than you. You're competing with direct out of the factory, cross-border e-commerce coming straight out of China now, AliExpress is planning to be able to ship within 48 hours at $3 a shipment anywhere in the world, and they're building the superhighway to do that. You know, so you know, if you're sitting there in Britain with your high cost base and you're thinking, you know, I'm going to be the low cost producer like I was 30 years ago, you're not. So a transactional price led philosophy will get you absolutely nowhere. As we've seen with the collapse of all these huge American store groups and British store groups, which, you know, were just basically large warehouses full of stock, and they've all collapsed, you know, one by one, because, you know, it's got too expensive to be able to retail that way. And so, you know, what it takes to be a brand now is completely different. And that's the key. And, you know, to me, that's the key, apart from channel management and exactly how you manage the two channels, that's the key to the future, is to see yourself as a brand and understand exactly how good you've got to be in order to be a successful new generation brand. And that's kind of my message, if you like.
Wow, this is great. In fact, yeah, you've given so many different dimensions to think about and come up with the right kind of a formula for success here. But clearly what I get out of it is that if the brand has a good, messaging and is able to communicate well with the customer and is able to deliver to the customer satisfaction, they have a good chance, fair chance of succeeding, because the customer is in much more control. They can spread the word, and they, when they talk about your brand, your people believe, and they would potentially do business with you. Whereas the incumbents or the legacy brands have been doing business much more differently, and for them, even though this idea is simple, but it is much harder to grasp for them because they've been doing business in a very different way for the last 30, 40 years. And it's a big change for those incumbents to make, because it's just that, like you said, you know, it was so simple for them, have a right kind of advertising run, have the item in stock, and you'll see customers buying it. Today, it doesn't happen, and this is why a lot of retailers are closing. But then, on the other side, we see that a lot of new retailers are coming up, and they are delivering on customer promise. They are bringing customer. They are, the experience of retailing is different. They are bringing in that consistency of pricing, product reviews, interaction, engaging the customers in the store. Not only that, in fact, lately we've seen that in America or globally, what we are seeing is a lot of these retailers are acquiring logistics companies so that they can deliver the item to the customer's home in same day or next day. So while back in the day, customer was doing last mile from store to the home, today it has now come on to the retailers. Even if you have stores, you have to not only have the right kind of product, engage the customer, but also get that item to the customer in time. The ease and speed of delivering what was ordered is super important. And then the other thing, like we've been talking about, that with the communications and all that internet thing, we have to bring our store to the customer, because like customers are on their phone, all this communication with all the social media, the retailers have to be present on these different channels, which is like bring your store to the customer. So the customer will come to you, visit your store. Finally, you know, I see that a lot of these retailers, the new generation retailers, are taking much more simple approach. Their stores are much smaller, and they are bringing in customers to experience the product, but not holding a whole lot of inventory. But at the same time, they are also figuring out the logistics of micro-fulfillment and all those things, so they can get item delivered to the customer in a day or two. So, like, you know, what do you think about these new retailing model, new stores that can deliver the buying experience for the customer, at the same time get the item delivered to them in like a day or two? Do you think we should have more inventory in the store, or should we have like a showrooming but then have it paired with a close by fulfillment centers for fulfilling the orders quickly? Because one thing for sure, if you cannot deliver the item within 24 hours. Like you said, like in 48 hours, AliExpress will deliver from China. If you cannot deliver in less than 24 hours, customer might not get order item from you. So like, what do you think, like, you know, this new smaller store models compared with the fast delivery services, how are these things going to play out in near future?
Well, I think you've more or less said it. I think that the key role of the stores channel is no longer to hold large amounts of inventory, because that can be done more cheaply and efficiently online. And also, having large amounts of inventory in store stops your store staff from being able to do what they really need to be doing, which is interacting with customers. Because I don't think many people realize, but actually over 50% of store staff activity is related to administrative and inventory type issues. You know, tagging and retagging and moving inventory, receipting it, counting it, and also things like till operation and cashing up and those sort of things, which are really non-value-added tasks. So if you want your staff, they're also very hard work, so if you want your staff to be fresh and to enjoy their job and to be available to spend large amounts of quality time with customers, you have to reduce the administrative burden on them. So all of that, and also it's very expensive to stock large amounts of inventory, because it means you have to have a large space. So, you know, I'm in great favour of you know, what I call compact lean stores, which are essentially stores to manage that customer interaction, to manage the brand experience and education and community with... You know, there are different ways you can run the model. You can have lean inventory. You can have inventory that you show but you don't sell. You can have bestseller inventory that you sell, but the sort of long tail of products, because every retailer has a long tail of products that don't sell that much in a month, that is done online. So there's different ways you can cut the model. But essential, as you've said quite rightly, to that lean store model, where the store role changes, is that it's got to be backed up by super efficient e-commerce system, because if you can't deliver 5 or 6 days, then the fact that you don't have so much inventory available in your stores is going to kill you. You've got to have, I mean, like Alibaba's got its Hema stores in grocery stores in China, which have, I think they have about 2,000, they have 30,000 SKUs available in the store, but only 2,000 of them are actually physically available. The others are all available on screens. So all the basics, like sort of washing powder, salt, you know, things that you don't really care about but you just want to reorder, they're all ordered on screens. And the store itself is devoted to live food, you know, really, it's really like super Whole Foods, you know, with lots of live food displays and also eating in store. You know, and it's got a great, like, market atmosphere. But a lot of the stuff, but it's the key to it is backed up in the major Chinese cities. It's backed up by a 2-hour delivery window, so everything you order on those screens is going to come to your home within 2 hours. So, you know, that's why it works, is because, you know, you can come in and, you know, you've got the food for tonight and it'll come to you within 2 hours. By the time you've gone home and showered or whatever, the food's there. So, you know, you've got to have both. It's a slick e-commerce system backing up a really fun experiential store where the staff's not exhausted all the time through administrative work. That, to me, is the sweet spot.
Wow, this is amazing. You know, this is something I would say the most valuable takeaway for me from this podcast episode is that it's like the store is slick and it's backed by a fast, efficient fulfillment system. So it's like an e-com and the physical retail blended in the right kind of formula. It's like it's a perfect mix of two things. So that's amazing. In fact, you know, I really like it. What it brings more recently, this is something I've been talking about and with different people, is that when we open a retail store, most of the time we are thinking about the footfall that we are going to get in the store, the physical footfall, maybe 200 people or 500 people coming in the store. But many retailers, most of the retailers, are ignoring the digital footfall of the people in that region. Each store is serving certain region and there are people who are browsing the product digitally or buying items on the screen. If you consider them also as a part of your retail business from that store, then the idea that you said there could be a micro fulfillment center paired to each physical location you have, or maybe like a three physical locations with one micro fulfillment center serving that region. That way we can actually address to the customer's need of express or the fast delivery within like 2 hours, at the same time deliver them a really rich experiential shopping experience, wherein, like I said, you know, the whole live food and dine-in and all those things available in the store, which can only be done in the store. They cannot be done on e-com. But the fulfillment and transactions can always be achieved in the e-com world or the digital world. Yeah, this is great. In fact, you know, I'm so happy that we had this conversation today. So before we close off, I want to ask you one final question. What excites you most when you think about future of the retail?
Well, I think something we haven't talked about, which is the third element of the tripod. So the first element is you know, what it takes to be a brand and building that out. Secondly, is the channel management. And then thirdly, the third element is the way that the retail property model is changing. So malls and high streets are also changing, and they're moving away from heavy fixed cost investment, long leases, long fit out periods, and then expecting that store to trade permanently for 10 years or whatever, away from that towards what I call the plug and play system. And mainly because the malls and high streets can't attract, there aren't enough anchor tenants anymore, because a lot of the anchor tenants have gone bust, and the property owners desperately need to attract a new pool of brand talent into their locations. And where are they going to get those from? They're not going to get them from the traditional incumbent retailers. They're going to have to get them either from international brands or from online players, and certainly the online players are not going to want to make the kind of long-term retailing commitment that used to be accepted. So they're going to want much shorter leases, much more flexible leases. A lot of the online players don't even understand retailing. They've got no idea how to do a staff rota. They've got no idea of how to do clock in, clock out. That's not their world. Their world is the world of data and of you know, social media marketing, etc. So if the malls want to attract this new generation of brands into their spaces, they're going to have to come up with this new plug-and-play model. And the way that I see the plug-and-play model working is that, you know, people are going to want to come in and run stores, physical, as a kind of campaign. So they're going to want, you know, an online player will say, look, we're in the New York market digitally, But you know, it's costing us this much to recruit new customers in the New York area through Facebook or through Google. If we can recruit them more cheaply through being able to show them our product directly and have them experience an immersive brand action in the store, then we should do that, and we'll do it for. But we want to do it for 9 months or something. We don't want to do it forever necessarily, because if we're going to target the New York market, we actually might want to have something in Grand Central Station for a bit, and then we might want to go into Hudson's Fields, and then we might want to go to the American Dream for a bit, because it's different customer bases, and we want to access all those customer bases. And once we've harvested them, we can always sell to them repeat online. We don't always have to be there physically. Once we've got them, you know, we're pretty damn good at hanging on to them digitally. So I see the plug-and-play model working like this. I think that the store setup changes from being a physical setup to being a digital setup. In other words, all the elements of the store become digital, right? All the branding becomes digital. So it all passes from, like, physical bits of furniture and the things that we put in stores to communicate the brand into digital screens. So I think the store windows become digital screens. I think the store walls largely become digital screens, where you can put in a new marketing chip and flip the brand like that overnight. And I think that also they're going to want to have stores that give them all the metrics that websites give them. So they're going to want to have all the camera technology, the hotspots and the real time data on footfall and conversion and dwell times and all those sort of things. They're going to want an engagement. They're going to want that in real time. So it needs to be kitted out with all that technology. And it doesn't make sense for the brand to own that technology and have to rip it out after 9 months and move it somewhere else. It makes much more sense for the mall owner to own that technology and be able to flip the brands through the space, to rotate the brands through the space. So I see malls evolving towards actually becoming brands themselves, collecting customer data, equipping their spaces with technology, and also with people. I actually think that they will have brand ambassadors whose job is not to manage stock and stuff, but to sell the product. But I think the brand ambassadors will belong to the malls. So when you rent a space in a mall for, say, 9 months or whatever, the brand ambassadors come with that, which enables also the mall to manage staff over lots of different outlets. Because we all know that when you walk into a mall, that you've got one store is crowded out and the staff can't cope. And 90% of the other stores, all the staff are standing there and there's no consumers in there. Right? That's got to be inefficient. It makes much more sense to manage the mall staff as a whole and send them to where the action is. So I think that the malls will own the staff and they will own the technology and the brands will rotate through. The advantage of all of that will be, number one, it'll be great for the brands because it will enable them to have a very flexible setup and to really work multi-channel to its maximum, to be able to harvest customers in a market, to know in real time whether marketing campaigns are working or not, or experiences are working or not, to be able to have their community gather in the stores and have events in the stores, and yet have the very strong online as well. And yet, from the mall's point of view, you know, they're going to have an exciting mix of new brands all the time passing through. So if you look from a consumer's point of view, what you're going to have is great experiential brands with really strong communities popping up in your mall, and it will rotate, it will change. So the mall becomes a really exciting place, or the high street, main street, becomes a really exciting place, which we all know it wasn't 30 years ago. If you look, in 1991, the high streets and malls were not exciting places. It was the same old boring brands in every location in the country. You know, it was all the same old tired brands. Not, again, just all doing the transactional model. Now, you're going to have hundreds of new brands popping up, doing great experiential models, and it'll become... And the mall itself will be a great experience. So, you know, I think that shopping then becomes a really fun, exciting activity with a kaleidoscope of brands that you're not necessarily expecting. And then, you know, you'll enter the brand universe, you'll go into their digital system, and then you'll probably repeat digitally. If you like the brand, you're just going to go on working, you know, buying from them digitally. And then, you know, next month there'll be some new brands, etc. And it'll always be exciting for the consumer. So I actually see a very rich future for the whole consumer space, much more exciting, much more innovative, combining the kind of really slick delivery and shopping transaction of the web with all the best things that stores can offer in terms of branding. And they're all backed up by brands that see, that understand that they have to do so much more for their consumers, to be more personalized, to have higher values, to help their consumers with their lives rather than just sell them a product. So I see really a very rich future for the whole consumer space.
Awesome. This is great. In fact, you know, you are showing us a light into future, because, like, you know, a lot of these malls now that are drying out, a lot of these are getting abandoned. We always think, are concerned that what is going to happen to all this mall economy, all these real estate investment. But if they go by the vision that you are showing us, then actually there is a reason why they will have something unique to offer, and the brand will have a real value when they come in, because for them it will be much easier to set up their store and move out when their job is done, which is amazing. In fact, we've seen more recently the services-based economy is evolving. We see Uber, Airbnbs, and all these things. So we've seen similar thing in hotels, like franchising. You own the property, but then a certain brand comes in and set up the hotel the way their brand is, but then they can move out of it after a few years. In this case, I see that, you know, a lot of those concepts that existed in other industry could be brought in into the retail, and the malls could become more of a marketplaces for future. In fact, you know, while you were saying, I was thinking that in America, we have these county fairs, right, wherein, you know, small businesses come in and put up their stores, and then there are like a few recreational activities in these county fairs. So like, you know, all these malls will become a happening place, much more interesting, because the new brands are coming in, and then malls, because they want to attract people, they will have all these different experiential things. So for me, mall is not... it's not something that doesn't change very static. Like today, if I go to mall once today, then, you know, I don't have to go there again next week because nothing is going to change. Or maybe in like 3 months, nothing is going to change. I'll go there to have a coffee, but not for anything exciting that I'm going to find, discover any new stuff. But if we go, like you said, then every time I go in there, I'll find something new, some new brands popping up and some new experience coming up. For that to succeed, like you said, mall owners have to really own their brand and be able to communicate with their local audience. Well, you know, I'm really happy that we had this conversation. A lot of good information. I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy it. So, you know, that I think we can leave it there. And Mark, I know I follow you on LinkedIn. Can you tell us to our audience how they can keep up with you, the new things you are doing and all those?
Sure. I mean, I'm on LinkedIn, so you just search Mark Pilkington. If you put retail recovery into Google, you know, you'll get lots of stuff on me. Also, my website is markpilkington.net, so Mark Pilkington, all one word, and then .net, so everything is on there, including my contact email details, etc. I'm on all the social media. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, so if you just put Mark Pilkington retail into those, it'll all come up. You know, I'm very happy also, you know, if anyone contacts you, Anil, to give my phone number or email address.
Awesome. Definitely, Mark, because, you know, I know you have such a wealth of knowledge and so much value to give to people in retailing community. I will for sure share your contact details with the people I come in contact and I see relevant. Once again, thank you very much for coming in for our podcast. And I hope our audience, I'm sure they're going to enjoy it. And so, you know, once again, thank you. And you have a great rest of the day.
Thanks for having me, Anil.
That's it for this episode of the Customer Centric Retailing Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and Google Podcast. Please rate and review and recommend to a friend or a fellow retail fanatic. This podcast is presented by Hotwax Commerce.